I have to kill this man. Pillsbury sucked in a sharp breath and fired. He watched the tracers skim away from his gun and punched through the Zero cockpit. The windshield blew apart and the pilot pitched forward. The Zero faltered like a wounded bird and fell from the sky. The last Zero came up, then dropped. Clarence Douglas, with his thigh, chest, and shoulder torn open, had risen to his gun and brought the plane down. Pillsbury slid into Louis's arms. Louis laid him beside Brooks and eased his boot off. Pillsbury screamed in pain. His left big toe was gone. The toe next to it hung by a string of skin, and portions of his other toes were missing. His lower leg bristled with shrapnel. Louis bandaged Pillsbury, gave him morphine, then hurried away to see if they could save the plane. Superman was dying. Its control cables were cut, one rudder was ruined, fuel was trickling onto the floor, and hydraulic fluid was sloshing in the bomb bay. Phil couldn't turn it with the normal controls, and the plane was pulling upward extremely hard, trying to flip. It was on the verge of stalling and was porpoising up and down. Phil did what he could. Slowing the engines on one side forced the plane to turn. Pushing the plane to high speed eased the porpoising and reduced the risk of stalling. By putting both feet on the yoke and pushing as hard as he could stop the plane from flipping. Funafuti was 5 hours away. If Superman could carry them that far, they'd have to land without hydraulic control of the landing gear, flaps, or brakes. They could work the gear and flaps with hand pumps, but there was no manual alternative to hydraulic brakes. Brakeless? Coming in fast, they might need 10,000 feet to stop. Funafuti's runway was 6,660 feet long. At its end were rocks and sea. Louis had an idea. What if they tied parachutes to the plane, pitched them out the windows at touchdown, and pulled the ripcords? No one had ever tried to stop a bomber this way, but it was all they had. They decided to try. Hours passed. Superman shook and struggled. Brooks gurgled blood. Pillsbury couldn't bear the sound. Brooks opened his eyes and whispered. Louis put his ear near Brooks's lips but couldn't understand him. Brooks drifted off. They all knew they'd probably crash on landing, if not before. No one spoke of it. At last, Funafuti appeared. Phil began dropping the plane. They had to slow down. Someone cranked open the bomb bay doors, and the plane, dragging on the air, began to slow. Douglas went to the landing gear pump. He needed two hands, one to push a valve and one to work the pump, but had only one working arm. Pillsbury couldn't stand, but by stretching, he reached the valve. Together, they got the gear down. Mitchell and Louis pumped the flaps down, and Louis and Douglas placed a parachute in each waist window and tied them to the gun mounts. Louis stood between the windows, holding the ripcords. Superman sank toward Funafuti. Pillsbury looked at the airspeed gauge. It read 110 miles per hour. For a plane without brakes, it was much too fast. For a moment, the landing was perfect, the wheels just kissing the runway. Then came a violent gouging sensation. The left tire had been hit and was flat. The plane caught hard and careened left toward two bombers. More out of habit than hope, Cuppernell stomped on the right brake. There was just enough hydraulic fluid left to save them. Superman spun around and stopped, barely missing the bombers. Louis was still gripping the parachute cords. He hadn't had to use them. In seconds, the plane was swarming with Marines, rushing the injured out. Louis jumped down and surveyed his ruined plane. All the bombers had returned, every one shot up, but none as badly as Superman. Later, ground crewmen would count its holes. 594. That evening, Pillsbury was lying in a barracks awaiting treatment. when a doctor came in and asked if he knew Harry Brooks. Pillsbury said yes. He didn't make it, the doctor said. Harold Brooks died days before his 23rd birthday. His fiancée Jeanette learned he was gone 9 days before the wedding date she and Harry had set, before he left for the war. Chapter 10. The whole island was blowing up. On the night after the Nauru raid, as he lay in a tent in Funafuti's coconut grove, Louis woke to a forlorn droning. It was a small plane crossing back and forth overhead. Thinking it was a crew lost in the clouds, he lay listening, hoping they'd find home. Eventually, the sound faded away. Before Louis could fall back asleep, he heard the growl of heavy aircraft engines. Then, from the atoll's north end, came a sudden boom. Then another, and another, each one louder. There was a siren and distant gunfire. Then a Marine ran by, screaming, "Air raid!" The droning hadn't been a lost American crew. It was probably a scout plane leading Japanese bombers. Funafuti was under attack. The airmen, Louis and Phil among them, jammed on their boots, bolted from their tents, and stopped, some spinning in panic. They couldn't see any bomb shelters. The explosions were getting louder and closer. The ground shook. Men ran for any cover they could find. Pilot Joe Deasy and several other men plowed into a shallow pit around a coconut sapling. Herman Skierce, Deasy's radio man, leapt into a trench next to a truck, joining 5 crewmates. Pilot Jesse Stay jumped into another hole nearby. 3 men crawled under the truck. Another ran into a garbage pit. 1 man ran right into the ocean, even though he didn't know how to swim. Dozens of natives crowded into a large white church. Realizing it would stand out brilliantly, a Marine ran in and ordered the natives out. When they wouldn't move, he drew his sidearm. They scattered. In the infirmary, Pillsbury lay in startled confusion. One moment he was asleep. The next, the atoll was rocking with explosions. A siren was howling, and people were dragging patients onto stretchers and rushing them out. Then Pillsbury was alone. He'd apparently been forgotten. He sat up, frantic. He couldn't stand. Louis and Phil ran through the coconut grove. Bombs were overtaking them, making a sound one man likened to a giant's footfalls. Boom, boom, boom. At last, with the bombs so close they could hear them whistling, they dove under a hut built on flood stilts, landing in a heap of men. An instant later, everything was scalding white and splintering noise. The ground heaved, the air whooshed, the hut shuddered, trees blew apart. A bomb struck the tent where Louis and Phil had been seconds before. Another hit the truck, sending it and the remains of the men under it skimming past Jesse Stay's head. Another bomb landed on a gunner in Skierce's trench. It didn't go off, but sat there, hissing. The gunner shouted, "Jesus!" It took them a moment to realize the bomb was actually a fire extinguisher. The bombs moved down the atoll. Each sounded farther away. Then the explosions stopped. Louis and the others stayed put, knowing the bombers would return. Matches were struck and cigarettes pinched in trembling fingers. "If we're hit," a man grumbled, "there'll be nothing left of us but gravy." Far away, the bombers turned. The booming began again. Someone, running by the infirmary, saw Pillsbury, raced in, and carried him into a tiny cement building where the other wounded had been taken. It was pitch dark and so crowded that men had been laid on shelves. Pillsbury lay, panting, listening to the explosions, feeling claustrophobic, imagining bombs, entombing them. The booming was louder, louder, and then it was overhead, tremendous crashing. The ceiling trembled, and cement dust sifted down. Outside, it was hell on earth. Men moaned and screamed, one calling for his mother. Men's eardrums burst. A man died of a heart attack. Another man's arm was severed. Others sobbed, prayed, and lost control of their bowels. Phil had never known such terror. Louis crouched beside him, seized with fear. Staff Sergeant Frank Rozenek huddled in a trench, wearing nothing but a helmet, untied shoes, and boxers. The bomb sounded like someone pushing a piano down a long ramp before they hit and exploded, he wrote. Big palm trees were shattered and splintered all around us. The ground would rise up in the air when a bomb exploded, and there was this terrific flash of super bright light. At intervals between a bomb falling, it sounded like church. Voices from nearby slit trenches, all chanting the Lord's Prayer together. Louder when the bombs hit closer. I thought I even heard some guys crying. You were afraid to look up because you felt your face might be seen from above. On the fourth pass, the Japanese hit the jackpot, bullseyeing a row of parked B-24s that were gassed up and loaded with bombs. One exploded, and another burst into flames, sending machine gun bullets whizzing everywhere, tracers drawing ribbons in the air. Then the 500-pound bombs on the planes started going off. Finally, silence. Men began stirring hesitantly. As they did, a B-24 blew in a gigantic explosion, accelerated by its 2,300 gallons of fuel and 3,000 pounds of bombs. It sounded, wrote one man, like the whole island was blowing up. With that, it was over. At dawn, men crept from their hiding places. The man who'd run into the ocean waded ashore, having clung to a rock for 3 hours in rising tide. Louis and Phil joined a procession of stunned, shaking men. Funafuti was wrecked. A bomb had leveled the church, but thanks to the Marine, no one had been inside. Where Louis and Phil's tent had been, there was only a crater. Another tent lay collapsed, a bomb standing on its nose, on top of it. Someone tied the bomb to a truck, dragged it to the beach, and turned sharply, sending the bomb skidding into the ocean. Where the struck B-24s had been, there were giant holes ringed by decapitated coconut trees. One crater was 35 feet deep and 60 feet across. Bits of bomber were everywhere. Landing gear and seats that had seen the sunset from one side of Funafuti greeted the sunrise from the other. All that was left of one bomber was a tail, two wingtips, and propellers. An engine sat alone on the runway. The plane it belonged to was nowhere to be found. Louis saw a journalist staring into a crater, crying. Louis walked to him, bracing to see a dead body. Instead, he saw a typewriter, flat as a pool table. The wounded and dead were everywhere. Two mechanics who had been caught in the open were bruised all over from the concussive force of explosions. They were so traumatized they couldn't talk. Men stood in a solemn circle around what was left of the truck. The three men who had been under it were beyond recognition. Louis came upon the body of a native, half his head gone. Phil was unscathed. Louis had only a cut arm. Louis went to the infirmary. Pillsbury lay with his leg hanging in the air, dripping blood on the floor. Coppernell sat with him, thanking him for shooting down that Zero. Pillsbury's leg, which a doctor described as hamburgered, needed immediate surgery. There was no anesthetic. As Pillsbury gripped the bed and Louis lay over his legs to hold them still, the doctor used pliers to tear tissue from Pillsbury's foot. then pulled a long strip of hanging skin over his toe-bone stump and sewed it up. Louis walked to Superman, which still sat where it had spun to a halt. The Japanese had missed it, but he couldn't tell by looking at it. Its 594 holes covered it. Swarms of bullet holes, shrapnel slashes, cannon fire gashes as large as a man's head, the gaping hole in Pillsbury's turret, and the rudder hole, big as a doorway. Men circled the plane, amazed that Phil had kept it airborne for 5 hours in that condition. Louis ran his fingers along the tears in the plane's skin. Superman had saved him and all but one of his crew. He would think of it as a dear friend. Louis boarded another plane and headed home with Phil, Coppernell, Mitchell, and Glassman. Pillsbury, Lambert, and Douglas were too badly wounded to rejoin the crew. Brooks was lying in Funafuti Cemetery. The crew was broken up forever. They'd never see Superman again. Back on Hawaii, Louis and Phil sank into depression. With a gutted crew and no plane, they were grounded. Louis ran obsessively, trying to forget Harry Brooks's stricken face. On May 24th, the Superman survivors were transferred to the 42nd Squadron of the 11th Bomb Group. Six new men replaced the lost crewmen. "Don't like the idea a bit," Louis wrote in his diary. "Every time they mix up a crew, they have a crack-up." The only thing noteworthy about the new men was that the tail gunner, Sergeant Francis McNamara, ate practically nothing but dessert. They called him Mac. B-24s destined for their squadron began arriving. One, Green Hornet, worried everyone. Even with an empty bomb bay and all four engines roaring, it was only just able to stay airborne, flying with its tail far below its nose. It was relegated to errands, and mechanics pried parts off of it for other planes. Louis flew in it briefly, called it the craziest plane, and hoped he'd never be in it again. Chapter 11. Nobody's going to live through this. On Thursday, May 27, 1943, Louis rose at 5 a.m. He pulled on his workout clothes, hiked to the runway, and began his morning mile run. 4 minutes and 12 seconds later, he finished. It was a dazzling time, given that he was running in sand. He was in the best shape of his life. After breakfast, he climbed into a car with Phil and Coppernell and headed for Honolulu for their day off. At the base gate, the despised lieutenant who oversaw their flights flagged them down. A B-24 piloted by a Tennessean named Clarence Corpening was missing, and they needed volunteers to hunt for it. Phil told him they had no plane. The lieutenant said they could take Green Hornet. When Phil said the plane wasn't airworthy, the lieutenant disagreed, saying it had passed inspection. Phil knew that though the word volunteer was being used, this was an order. He volunteered. The lieutenant woke pilot Joe Deasy and recruited his crew as well. They'd take the B-24 Daisy May. Phil, Louis, and Coppernell turned back to round up their crew. Stopping at his room, Louis opened his diary. "There was only one ship, the Green Hornet," he wrote. "We were very reluctant. But Phillips finally gave in for rescue mission." Just before he left, Louis laid a note on his footlocker, in which he kept his liquor, hidden in mayonnaise jars. "If we're not back in a week," it read, "help yourself to the booze." Meeting the crews at Green Hornet, the lieutenant unrolled a map. He believed Corpening had gone down 200 miles north of Palmyra, an island several hours south of Hawaii. He assigned each crew a search area. Preparing for takeoff, everyone worried about Green Hornet. Without heavy bombs aboard, Louis told himself, the plane should be able to stay airborne. Phil was concerned that mechanics had removed parts from the plane. He hoped nothing critical was missing. The crew reviewed crash procedures and checked survival equipment. There was a provisions box